So it's Tuesday afternoon, Pulling Up the Sofa. We do this every day, a different guest with us every day. And my sofa guest with us today has just published his first novel. David Laws has been a journalist all his life. He's worked for much of the time with the Express newspaper, but has now joined the ranks of authors. And the book is Munich, The Man Who Said No. Congratulations.
Thank you.
And I know in your notes to me you said how exciting it is to hold when you first got your copies through. What was it like just to hold
it? Oh, it's just fantastic to get hold of your first book and to feel it. It feels very chunky. And I just opened it at random and thought, oh, yes, I remember writing that bit. And turn a few pages, and yes, it's there. You can hardly believe that the words you put into the computer have actually come out, and here they are in a book, and it just looks fantastic.
Although you can't be, I mean, you must be quite used to seeing your words in print, but this is a totally different experience.
It is a totally different medium. To actually see it in book form is completely different to seeing it in a newspaper.
So tell me, without spoiling it, whet our appetites, tell us what it's about. Munich, The Man Who Said No.
Well, it stems from my interest in the steps up to a major conflict like the Second World War. Now, I've always wondered why somebody didn't go up to him and say, look, this is a really bad idea to go and talk to somebody like Hitler. He's a gangster. He won't keep his word. And I'm amazed that nobody actually did that. So I thought, I'm going to write a book about a man who did. So I've created this character who is an American radio correspondent, and he's aghast at what Chamberlain is doing, and he gate crashes the Munich conference with all the big cheeses there: Mussolini, Ribbentrop, Goering, Hitler, of course, and Daladier, the French Prime Minister. He gate crashes the conference, goes up to Chamberlain and says, no, don't do it, don't sign, he's a gangster, he won't keep his word. And, of course, this creates something of a diplomatic incident. Yes, they're not terribly keen on this. In fact, they rub him out and they disappear him from history, and nobody knows what happens to him. So in 2015, his granddaughter comes along and says, I'm going to find out what happened to my grandfather. And she's uniquely qualified to do this. She's a Cambridge history academic. She's feisty, prickly, aggressive, and lives in Bury St Edmunds.
I was going to say there is a local link here, which is brilliant.
And she goes down the road, embarks on this voyage of discovery of what happened to her grandfather. Did he survive this incident? Did he have a life afterwards? So that's the basis
that's
of the story.
And it's been on sale a little while, and you've done book signings. What have people told you about the book?
Well, I've had lots of very positive feedback. I got an email from a lady the other day, only about 2 days after I'd sold her the book. She emailed to say how much she loved it, and she'd read it right the way through straight away and thought it was brilliant. And when am I writing my next one?
And are you?
Of course.
So it's in the making. How much research? Because it's one thing to get the idea, isn't it? Another is to flesh it out. It's a lot of research.
Yes. I mean, I've always been interested in the subject, so I've read fairly widely about the causes of war. But most particularly, I was inspired by William Shirer, the American radio correspondent who wrote the seminal book, The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, and what he said about Munich and what he said about Chamberlain. And that's really started me off. And the fact that I went to Munich for quite another reason and fell in love with this city, it's just a fantastic place. And I spent a lot of time there. And my research consisted of tramping round the streets and getting a feel for the city and going, obviously, to the museums and watching these endless newsreels and going to all the places where the Nazis and Hitler had left his footprint. But also I love the city. In particular, I love the trams, because if you get on a tram, you get a real feeling for the city. You have the opportunity to people watch, to study the people sitting on the tram. They're not sort of poshed up going on a long journey like you might find on a long distance train. They're going to work, or they're going to the shops, or they're doing whatever they do. And you see some of these fantastic people, this old lady sitting there with three raincoats on and a green pork pie hat. Or as another guy with about 29 badges all over his jacket. There's another guy with about three double chins and a funny hat, you know, and you can have lots of fun.
Did you make notes?
I made notes afterwards, yeah. I didn't make notes in front of them, no. But, yeah, you get a feel for the city, you know, the trams grinding round the streets and the wheels are squealing and the old ding, 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 yeah. The old bells going. And you get a real feel for the city, jumping on and off trams and going to different places, as well as all of the important places that are necessary in the story.
So that gives you the feel, doesn't it? And how did you find the writing of the book? I mean, as I said, you've written articles, you've written news copy and so on, but how did you find this in comparison?
Well, it's completely different. You obviously have to do a lot of research and a lot of story development. You can't. Well, you can.
Did you sketch it out? Did you flesh it? Did you write it out before you started?
Oh, yes. Yeah. I mean, I wrote a long synopsis and developed the story from that, and then had a scene list. Obviously, you ask yourself, okay, I'm now telling this story, but I've actually got to show how it happens. So, how am I going to show it? Think of a film. So, how does a film work? A film works through scenes. So, I'll make a list of scenes in which I can show how this story develops. And then, of course, I spent a lot of time thinking about the characters, researching radio correspondence and various people that I have in the story. And then I obviously did wrote a first draft. And then I played it to consultants who tore it to pieces, story analysts, and took on board a lot of what they said, and also did a writing course in the middle of it.
I was going to say, was it the UEA you went to?
It was, yes.
Well known for their courses, aren't you?
They're very good courses, and the teachers are very, very good. And so, you know, it took me quite a long time because I did lots of other things while I was doing it.
Yeah, but did you enjoy it?
Absolutely. I can't think of a better job than to sit down and invent a story, develop it, and write it, and go through the whole process.
And you've come to that point where you're having the book signings and so on. And I've often spoken to authors, and writing's quite a solitary thing, isn't it? So sitting there, and then the book signings is totally the opposite.
Absolutely. I mean, I really enjoyed book signing because people come up to me, and when I'm talking to them about it, they say, oh, so I've visited the city. Or, yes, my dad was a German prisoner of war. And another guy the other day came up to me and said, well, I've got a very interesting story to tell you because my father was very pro-German in the 1930s and thought they were the coming thing. And we all had to learn German and went off to Germany to do holidays. And my father was sitting in this restaurant in Berlin one evening, when the door opened and in walked Adolf Hitler, followed by this enormous entourage. And all the Germans immediately leapt to their feet. Heil! And they said to him, come on, get your feet. And he said, no, Hitler, bad news. I'm not standing for him. And he was an awkward man. And he was the only man in the restaurant who wouldn't stand for Hitler. Next evening, he left Berlin in a hurry.
Wow. That's an amazing story, isn't it?
Well, it gets even better because this man was engaged to a German lady. And the families said, oh, this is very dangerous. I don't think we better go through with this. And they broke it off. And then so this man married an English lady and the German lady married a German and the war came along. But after the war, they got together. And so my informant said, and then these people came to visit us and I met the lady who so nearly was my mother.
I was going to say, but that's your next book, isn't it? The man who wouldn't stand for Hitler.
Well, that's right, yes.
That's the title already. Well, so I mean, this is really good. And you've said that the next book is underway. So Munich, The Man Who Said No. I'm intrigued as well, because often I speak to authors, Anthony Horowitz amongst them, and they say characters come alive and start to take on their own life. Did you find
Absolutely,
that?
Absolutely, yes. I mean, the more
Did
you
Did they
work...
start to do things that you didn't expect?
Yeah, that's the usual thing, yes. Well, my characters fortunately haven't misbehaved enough to make me change the story.
So they haven't taken on their own character just yet? Not just yet. My guest with us today, a sofa guest with us today, is David Laws. He's published his very first novel, Munich, The Man Who Said No. And we've just learned he is busy writing his second one as well. But I think pretty much most of your life you wanted to be a journalist and you were a journalist. And it all started quite early on, didn't it? Didn't you read a book that inspired
you? Yes, I read a book called The Monday Story. And you're a journalist, so you know this. The Monday Story is the hardest story, because as a newspaper you're covering yesterday's news, and yesterday was Sunday. And if you're a local paper, nothing happens on a Sunday. So the Monday Story is the hardest one, and it's all about a district reporter. And I was absolutely completely taken by this story. It was a fictional story, but it was completely true to life. And as soon as I'd read it, I thought, That's what I want to do. This is it. And
how old were you about at that stage?
I think probably about 11 or 12, maybe even earlier. I can't remember exactly. But I know that by the time I was 13, I was into writing my own magazine.
Yeah, because you actually did compile your own magazine. You had someone type it up
and copy it for you and everything.
It's brilliant.
I was lucky because my cousin, who lived just round the corner, worked in a government camp nearby, and she had access to, obviously, a typewriter and a Gestetner duplicating
machine.
Which
I do remember. A lot of people now will have no idea what they were.
That's right, where they were very old-fashioned means of duplicating copies.
You sort of rolled
copies.
It round, didn't
yes.
you? And you got very inky and
that's
all
right.
the process. But you could duplicate material.
That's right. And before then, you have to cut a stencil on your typewriter, and then you put it on the Gestetner machine. And I can't remember whether you have to turn the handle or whether it's electrical.
Well, it depends. I guess it depends on the one you have.
Yes, that's right. I can quite imagine her turning the handle in this office, spewing out copies of my magazine, and then it was all stapled together. And I remember we had a cover as well, which...
What was it called?
It was called Opinion.
So you had an opinion even at that
stage.
And I gather you were quite a rebel of that era.
That's right, because it was a... And it's going back a long while, but at that time, I was quite young, and it was at the time of the Korean War. And Britain obviously was involved with America in fighting the communists in North Korea, which is obviously now very topical. And my stance on it was that I was against British involvement in it. And of course, that wasn't a terribly popular thought at the time. It was a time of great patriotism when everybody wanted to back our boys and so forth. Quite rightly. But my angle was that, we shouldn't be involved. And I remember my father saying, you might get in trouble with this.
A bit worried. But you went out and sold copies, so people bought it, didn't they?
Absolutely, because I went round to I sold it mainly to my school friends in the playground, but also to those who I knew on the estate where I lived. I can't remember how much I sold it for, 2 or 3 pence or something, and because it didn't cost me anything.
It's quite entrepreneurial, though, wasn't it?
It wasn't sort of a business idea. It was
because you wanted to write.
It was journalism. It was my first venture into journalism. And so that was
and
that.
I think once you left school, your first job wasn't quite in journalism. It was on the telephone exchange.
That's right. My first job was in a little paper called the City Press. And it was a wonderful little office just round the corner from the Bank station. And it had lots of journalists there. And I did get a couple of journalistic jobs, but mainly I was operating the telephone. And in those days, we had one of these really old-fashioned telephone exchanges where they sort of the rosewood cabinet, and in front of you would be a line of plugs.
So you put jack plugs in to
jack
connect
plugs,
people.
And then there would be a little dial in front of a little... dial thing in front of you, and when it showed up, somebody was ringing in. So you'd put forward this little key and pick up one of the plugs and plug it into the hole and say, you know, hello, City Press, can I help you? And they say, oh, yes, can I speak to Mr. Smith, please? So you pick up the corresponding plug and plug it into Mr. Smith's number and then buzz him with this little key. And they would pick up and say, hello, Smith here. And you, I, as a telephone operator, was then supposed to put the key back so that they could have this private conversation. But being a snoopy little 16-year-old, I kept the key forward and I listened in. But after a time, of course, they got wise to this and said, David, put that damn plug back.
and so you, I mean, I don't know how long you were there, but you ended off doing nationals, ended up doing national service.
Well,
you,
I went from the City Press and another guy told me, oh, there's a great paper out at Ruislip. You want to apply to that? So I applied to that and I got on that. I was really pleased and I became a district reporter. And I was there for 2 or 3 years until it was my time to go for national service. I think I was probably one of the last ones to go in. So I did my national service.
Which service did you get in?
I went into the army, the Royal Army Service Corps. And I went to Germany. I got posted to Germany. And that's what I suppose that whetted my interest as
Munich?
Well. No, it wasn't Munich. It was in the American. Munich is in Bavaria. It was in the American zone. I was in the British Army, the Rhine zone, at a place called Sennelager, which is in the North Rhine-Westphalia. And then later I was sent back to Mönchengladbach, which was the British Army, the Rhine headquarters, which is a fantastic place. And then I got posted to Paris on detachment to work on what was then a top secret project, what the Allies were going to do if the Russians cut off Berlin. And that was quite fascinating because they did all the contingency planning about what the army would do. And, you know, there were strange conversations planned between a British tanky and a Russian tanky, and what the British tanky had to say to the Russian. I often wondered, well, they don't speak each other's language.
How are
they going to
do that?
How are they going to do it? But anyway, it was a fascinating time. And then after my army service, I came out and joined another local newspaper group and ended up at Wembley, which is a really fascinating place to be.
And that's where you ended up doing all your proper training, so shorthand things.
Yeah, well, I'd already mastered shorthand because I'd gone to Pitman's College where I did my education, also in Wembley, by pure coincidence. But the journalist training was brilliant because, as you know, there's a blank day in every weekly newspaper, and that's publication day. So if publication day is Friday, there's nothing for a journalist to do. He's dead. So they sent us off to college to learn all the sort of theory of it and, you know, pass all the exams and so forth.
And I know the day that, because I think it was Manchester you went to first of all, wasn't it, as a sub-editor with the Daily Express, and that was the day you felt you'd made it.
Absolutely.
Is that right?
By this time I was married, and my wife came with me for the interview. I was terribly nervous, and she stayed in the centre of Manchester. There's some Piccadilly Gardens. There's beautiful gardens. I said, don't want you coming with me. You stay in Piccadilly Gardens and eat your sandwiches, and I'll walk down the road to Great Ancoats Street, where this fantastic Daily Express building was. And it was all black glass, huge place, and there was a viewing gallery where you could see the machines going. So it was a wonderful thing for sightseers anyway. So I went to this interview, and I was interviewed by the editor, who decided in his wisdom that he would take me on. And he said, what are you earning? So I said, £24 a week. He said, oh, I'll give you a £5 rise. And so I came out of there and I walked up Great Ancoats Street to Piccadilly Gardens, where my wife was waiting, waving my hand. I'm earning £29 a week. It's like being in Hollywood. I'm on film star wages. We couldn't believe our luck. So this was a great moment in my life, 1966, I remember.
Although I gather it was quite a scary place to work.
And it was a very scary place to work. I went in there and it was this vast open plan office. Well, it seemed to be, well, obviously weren't hundreds, but it seemed to be hundreds of people there.
Well, they slept typewriters, I guess.
Well, no, I was a sub-editor by this time, so no typewriters, no. Okay. No, you had a pad of copy paper, a spike, a biro, and a scissors, and a glue pot. That was your tools of the trade. And you, all the sort of junior sub-editors sat at these benches. And it was very competitive. I mean, I've been used to offices where they were friendly, where they would address you as David or Fred or whatever. But here it was very competitive. And somebody gave you something to do and you really beavered away at it and submitted it. And if the person looking at it said, I don't like that very much, and the guy sitting next to you wouldn't commiserate with you, you'd say, didn't do very well there, did you?
In the hopes that he would then get his copy accepted.
And the elderly, the more sort of senior sub-editors, you had to address as Mr. And I'd seen lots of films in my early days as the newspaper offices in America where they wore green eye shades. And I thought, well, this is just Hollywood. But when I got to the Daily Express office in Manchester, there was the most senior sub-editor with his green eye shade. I was fascinated by this. And I made excuses to go and talk to him. Excuse me, Mr. Smith. That wasn't actually his name. Excuse me, Mr. Smith. How long have you been here? And can I borrow your glue pot?
Not the green eye shade. But no. And in your notes, you say that the rats are the back benches, the mice are the middlemen, and the busy bees are the front rows. That's how it really works.
That's right, because all the back bench, all the really big cheeses, the editor and the night editor and the assistant night editor and the deputy editor and the assistant deputy night editor, all sat in this row glaring at you. And in the middle were the sort of junior executives who directed the actual work. And then us lot on all these benches. There are about three rows of benches. There are such a lot of people. It's such a contrast to now.
I was going
to
say, it's such a difference, isn't it, to how it's just... Yeah, I mean, were you there when it was slowly sort of pared down?
Well, you know, it's sad. I mean, I go into the office now and there are perhaps four or five down-table sub-editors, you know, and then in those days there'd be about 30. And you'd be competing to do the most minor thing. And it would be, you know, and you'd spend just hours crafting a beautifully constructed 27-word sentence or a one-line headline with 14 characters in it. You'd spend ages trying to get something absolutely fantastic. And I remember my first tiny piece that I got in the paper of 27 word short, and it was about a record number of flower entries in the Shrewsbury Flower Show. And I think my headline was something like Bloom Boom, which I was very proud of at the time. That was the first headline I got in the Daily Express.
What about your first byline, where you actually had your name attributed?
Well, as sub-editors, you don't get bylines.
No.
You only get bylines on when you write articles. And I got a few of those when I wrote about other authors, actually. I had a... I interviewed Jack Higgins and went to the Jersey to do it. That was a fabulous trip, sitting in Jack Higgins' fantastic Channel Islands house on this sort of balcony overlooking the sea and on the side of the cliff. It was just fantastic.
And I know that so you were in Manchester a while, then you did get to Fleet Street.
Yes,
didn't you, as well?
3 years later, I thought, I've got to get to Fleet Street. So I said to the editor, sorry, my granny's died and I need to get to London. He said, oh, God, not another dead granny. Go on then. And he sent me down to London, where they went through the motions of interviewing me. And I got to London Funnily enough, it was a lot more friendly in Fleet Street than it was in Manchester.
How funny, isn't it? Yes. And you did all sorts, didn't you? So you didn't, so not just sub-editor, you'd be nighttime, you'd work through the night.
Well, we called it the mouse race, because these are the guys who sit in the middle, climbing the ladder, you know, doing the forum page or the overnight pages, which were called flong pages, and then sitting up doing copy tasting or late chief sub editing and things like that.
So that's all really more about the layout, isn't it, of the paper? And
yes,
and
absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, the chief sub editor in those days was an incredibly powerful figure. He chose all the stories to go on the inside pages, and the backbench only operated on page one, because then it was a broadsheet paper, and their proud boast was that they would have at least 21 stories on page one. It's a joke now, you're lucky if you get more than one, but and they also did the forum page at that time. So the chief sub-editor did all the inside news pages, so he's a very powerful figure. So if you could do that job, you really thought, you know, yeah, I'm making it. And I did that on a sort of slot-filling basis when he was on holiday or wasn't feeling
well. Stand-in, yes.
I did a lot of stand-in jobs. And I think the sort of highest point that I went to was as a sort of regional night editor, where you decided what stories were going in the regional pages. And you could actually direct the chief sub, whom the previous week I'd been, into what he should do.
Did you enjoy it?
I absolutely enjoyed it.
Yeah,
I loved it. I love every moment of that.
Yeah, so I guess just the atmosphere and so on. And you have to write about it, you know, because I'm sure you can set one of your stories in the office. I mean, you obviously paint such a good picture of it now.
Yeah.
I know you stayed on. Did you freelance when you sort of, because you left mid-90s, didn't you?
Well, when I say freelance, I go in on a Saturday on the Sunday
do some
Express
extra work for them.
And do extra work for them, yeah.
And covered Marchioness disaster, Princess Diana's death as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Those,
they were weekend
those,
events,
they were
they?
Highlights, because they happened in the early hours of Sunday morning. So I was very heavily involved.
Which was quite hard work to get those out, I guess.
Absolutely, because I was virtually the only one there. And so I did the whole job myself. And with the Marchioness disaster, of course, it happened almost within sight of the office. And it was in the early hours of one Sunday morning, and I was a bit bored, so I'd left my position, and I was looking out of the window at the river, and I saw all these policemen looking over the bridge into the river. And I thought, well, policemen don't look into a river unless there's something going on. So I stirred up the news desk and got them to start phoning round and finding out what's happened. And then we were on to this story, and then it just developed on and on and on. And so, we replated and did lots of late editions on that.
I was going to say, something like that is such a terrible story, but in a way it's what you're made for, isn't it, in terms of newspapers?
It's an appalling
to get that
story.
Paper out with it, with that story on the front page and
yes,
so on.
That's what the sort
and
of...
the same with Princess Diana as well.
Absolutely. I mean, that was a terrible story, but it was a developing story throughout the night, and we only knew at the beginning that she was involved in a road crash. That was the first replate, and then we understood that she was injured. That was the next one. And then finally we discovered that she'd actually lost her life. So that was another one. And I remember I'd stayed so long in the office past my normal time then that I think it was probably about 7 o'clock in the morning. And I drove home behind the Daily Express van, which was delivering papers that I'd just been writing, yeah.
So how did you come to be a Suffolk boy? Because you grew up in London, I think, mostly, didn't you?
That's right. My grandfather came from Suffolk. But that was the reason I came to Suffolk was purely accidental, really. Unfortunately, my first wife, we were living at Harrow, and my first wife had just died from cancer. And I was a bit at sea, and I went to live with my son, who at that time was living in Grays in Essex, and then Brentwood. And then I met another lady, and we got together, and we thought, well, we better start looking for somewhere to live. So we started looking in Brentwood and around Essex, and my search just extended further and further.
Quite a lot of people do that. They look further and further and further.
That's right. And eventually we got to Suffolk and thought, this is just amazing place. Yes, let's buy here.
So, are you glad?
Absolutely glad. I feel really privileged to live in such a wonderful county. And I'm a bit of a walker, and I just love walking in Suffolk. It's just absolutely brilliant.
And I'm glad you've included a bit of Suffolk in your first novel as well, Bury St Edmunds, isn't
it? Absolutely, yeah. Yes, which I think is a beautiful town and a super place to set a location.
Does Suffolk feature in your next book?
It does indeed. I try to keep my English characters with a Bury St Edmunds location.
Brilliant. Well, as you say, it's easy when you know the place as well. Yes. And tell me about your love of trains, because you drive them, don't you?
Well, not as a job, no.
No, I didn't know as a hobby, though.
As a hobby, yes. As a boyhood thing, I've always been interested in railways, and it's just sort of escalated from there. And somebody suggested that I might like to go to Poland to look at the railways there. So I said, fine. And we went on this trip to Poland, and we travelled on all these trains, and we had rides on the footplate, and we got to some steam depot and said, OK, you can learn how to do it. So we had a sort of half-mile shunt up and down with this big loco. And I thought, wow, this is for me.
This is the life.
This is for me. So my next trick was to become part of a UK team that was driving an express locomotive pulling what was called the Blues Express. And it was a very Polish thing, a bit like one of our music festivals, Glastonbury, only this was a jazz festival, and it was held in a village in the north of Poland in a quite remote location. So the drill was, we'd get up really early and go to the loco depot, and the Polish crew had already fired it up, and they thought, well, we're going to teach these English guys a thing or two, so here's some rags and here's a large pot of oil, get up there and start polishing it.
Grease,
everything. So, wiping grease off a smoke shield is like scraping mud off your shoes. You know, it's a tremendous undertaking. Anyway, we got on the loco and we ran the loco light, as they say, from this steam depot onto the main line and up to the second city, which is Poznan, where we took on coal and water, and then found our train and hitched up to the train, and then drew into the Poznan station. And there on the platform were hundreds of people, and in the middle of them was a jazz band.
Fantastic.
Playing away. Wow. On the platform. And they were all dancing to this jazz band playing on the platform. And when the train drew in, they just went potty. They climbed all over the train. They climbed up on the engine, and they wanted to look in the fire and find out, you know, how it worked and all the rest of it. And there were little girls dressed in pink fairy dresses who were clambered up. And the engine driver, who's an amazing guy, the chief Polish engine driver, found possibly the only clean rag in the place and wiped her hands and wiped his hands and then handed her back to mum more or less intact.
That would have been a great newspaper photo, wouldn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Look, we've got one more key question. We'll do that in just a minute or two. Got to bring you right up to date with the latest travel news first.
Travel news from BBC Radio Suffolk.
It's Barry.
Thanks very much, Leslie. Still very busy around Sudbury, although it's improved a little bit from what it was earlier on. There are roadworks and temporary lights at Ballingdon Crossroads, A131. They're very heavy both ways, especially southbound heading out of Sudbury, with extra traffic as a result all the way back onto Friar Street and King Street. Newton Road seems to have eased up at least. And around Ipswich, also starting to build up now, particularly if you're northbound on the A12, the Cop Dock interchange. Actually, that seems to have eased up, if anything. But the westbound side of the A14 at Cop Dock Junction 55 just starting to look busy in Ipswich, Felixstowe Road, and also the Norwich Road looking slow on the speed sensors. Trains looking okay across the county this afternoon. I'm Barry Lewis for BBC Radio Suffolk Travel. If you see something or can update me, call 0800 141 2121.
On DAB, digital radio, This is BBC Radio Suffolk.
Stephen Foster on the way. Getting all warmed up, ready with you between 4 and 7. Latest news of the day. You're going to hear about a local production, theatre production, and good music on the way as well. So Foz with you between 4 and 7 here on BBC Radio Suffolk. My guest has been David Laws. So David, final key question. Should be more complicated than pineapple on pizza. What's this one?
Where was your last holiday?
Uh-huh.
And that was in Switzerland, where I was walking. I did a walking holiday in Switzerland. And I didn't intend, we were talking earlier about railways, and I didn't intend it to be a railway holiday, but just by chance, one of the trails that you can walk along was alongside one of the railways that wove its way up the mountainside, across the top and down the other side. Of course, it's now in a tunnel, the modern one, but the old-fashioned trains, which you can still go on over the top of the mountain.
And were they like rat railway?
Lots of rat railways to go up the high mountains, but this was an ordinary railway. And there is a fantastic story how they built it and all the accidents they had and so forth. And I was able to walk this footpath alongside the railway and through some of the old tunnels that were abandoned.
It's a holiday made for you, wasn't it?
It was absolutely a holiday made for me, yes.
Very quickly, so your book, Munich, The Man Who Said No, you've got a signing coming up in Colchester at Waterstones.
Correct.
Have I got that right? What date is it? 15th of May.
19th
of May. Yes. It helps if I get that right. Saturday, 19th of May. And I think that's in the morning, 10 o'clock as well.
That's right.
So people can come along, meet you, get a copy of the book and you'll sign it for them as well.
Yes, and we no doubt have a chin wag along the way.
And do you know the title yet? Is it still in...
This is still going to be
next
Munich.
One
no, is, this is going to be Munich.
Okay. No, but what about your next book?
What's the next book is going to be called Exit Day.
Exit Day. Is that another history, bit of history? Is it?
No, it's about Brexit.
Listen on. That would be very good. We'll get you back. It's been lovely chatting. Thank you so much for coming in.